Welcome to Faith and Family, a radio outreach of Family Life Center International. And now from Greenville, South Carolina, here's your host, Steve Wood.
Hello, this is Steve Wood, and welcome to Faith and Family. And today we're going to talk about a subject important to all Christians, but especially, I believe, for parents of teens. The Catechism of the Catholic Church teaches us that it is very important to get our basic orientation in life, to know our origin, to know where we came from, and also we need to know where we are going. And from these two fixed positions, so to speak, our origin and our destiny, we can find our identity, we can find our purpose, we can find what we're supposed to be doing in life. And today we're going to be talking about an exciting new discipline called intelligent design. Seeing the hand of intelligence at the smallest levels within God's creation. I'd like to begin the show today by reading a paragraph written by Cardinal Ratzinger in his book, In the Beginning, subtitled, A Catholic Understanding of the Story of Creation and the Fall. And I quote, "Let us go directly to the question of evolution and its mechanisms. Microbiology and biochemistry have brought revolutionary insights here. We must have the audacity to say that the great projects of the living creation are not the products of chance and error. They point to a creating reason and show us a creating intelligence, and they do so more luminously and radiantly today than ever before." You know, it takes a while. Sometimes it takes a couple of generations for the findings of science to make its way into the popular mind, into the media, and particularly into our children's textbooks. So today we're going to find out some of the latest findings of science and reflecting in a new discipline called intelligent design. Our special guest today is Dr. Michael Behe, and he's joining us from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Dr. Behe is the author of a book entitled Darwin's Black Box, subtitled The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. And we're going to be recommending that book to you through the broadcast today. Dr. Behe is an associate professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University, and he's joining us by phone today. Dr. Behe, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be with you.
Well, it's very exciting to have you here. Tell us a little bit about, first of all, your family background. We'd like our guests just to know a little bit about the family life of our guests.
Well, I'm married. I met my wife in New York City when I was an assistant professor at Queens College, and we moved to Bethlehem about 14 years ago, and we've got 8 children now. Our youngest is Helen. She was born 3 months ago, and 4 boys and 4 girls, and we attend St. Teresa's Church, is about a mile away from our home, and we homeschool our children.
Okay, now, you are a professor of biochemistry at Lehigh, mm-hmm. and tell us a little bit about your educational background, your professional background.
I went to college at Drexel University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where I got a bachelor's degree in chemistry, and I went to graduate school at the University of Pennsylvania, which is also in Philadelphia. Got a PhD in biochemistry, and my thesis work was on sickle cell disease, so we studied sickle cell hemoglobin. And after graduating from Penn, I went on to do what are called postdoctoral studies at the National Institutes of Health in outside of Washington, D.C., and I worked there for 4 years working on something called chromatin structure. It's the interaction of DNA with proteins in your cells. And then I got my first job, as I mentioned earlier, at Queens College in New York City. I was an assistant professor there for 3 years in the chemistry department. And I moved to Lehigh in the mid-'80s, and now I'm a professor in the biology department here at Lehigh.
Michael, before we get going, we better define what we are talking about, because intelligent design is really something new that's come to the fore. Distinguishing from perhaps more commonly understood as a creationist apologetic. So tell us what we mean by intelligent design.
Well, by intelligent design, we simply mean that you can tell from the way that a system works or the way something has been set up that it has been intentionally arranged that way, that it's not an accidental aggregation of things, that some intelligent agent came in and arranged things so that they would work in a certain way, so that they would fulfill some purpose. And one example of that, I sometimes show audiences. I have a little cartoon, a Far Side cartoon that I show, and it shows a bunch of jungle explorers walking along, and the lead explorer is dangling by a vine around his ankle, and some wooden saplings have been set up so that they have trapped him, and some of the limbs have skewered him. And I point out to the audiences that as soon as they look at the cartoon, they realize that this was an intelligently designed trap. It was not an accidental arrangement of parts. And as a matter of fact, the humor of the cartoon depends on you recognizing the intelligence. And the point is that you can apprehend intelligent design just by the way a system works. And intelligent design in biology now is the idea that we can tell that biological systems and cellular systems were, in fact, purposely designed because of the way their parts work.
Okay, now, when we talk about intelligent design, as you're defining it, are we talking about science or religion?
Well, we're talking about science.
Okay.
The thing is that if you think back to that cartoon that I tried to describe, it's not a religious conclusion to decide that that trap in the jungle was designed. You decide that it was designed because of the empirical evidence, because of the physical evidence, because of the way the parts are working together. In the same way, if you look at a biological system or molecular systems like I talk about in my book, and you see these little molecular trucks and railroad tracks and this outboard motor called the bacterial flagellum and so on, it doesn't take a religious person to see that the way their parts interact strongly suggests that they were arranged that way. So the conclusion of intelligent design is, in fact, a scientific one.
Okay. Now, obviously, how we got here, how we were designed, has implications for the big questions of where we came from and our origin, our destiny, and such. But it seems to me that intelligent design can be a nice public square meeting place for folks of all types of persuasions, religious and non-religious, on this issue to say that let's look at this from a scientific viewpoint. My goodness, our culture is so scientifically oriented to really use our brains and look at what is there, the objective evidence. And to me, it's kind of a more neutral meeting place of minds and hearts.
Yes, I agree with you. Another thing about intelligent design is it really doesn't say who the designer is. The designer of, you can look at a cell or you can look at some biological system and understand that it was designed, but you and I will ascribe the design to most likely to God, whereas somebody else might ascribe it to another designer.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question of who the designer is a separate question. And so you're right. I think it's because of that, it's more or less a neutral meeting ground for a discussion of how we got here and what put together the really astoundingly complex systems that life requires. And even non-believers, I think, can come and discuss our origins from such a perspective.
You know, I'm a former Protestant pastor, and I guess some of my pastoral instincts are kind of coming alive here. But one of the things, to be a good pastor, it's like leading sheep. You need to lead them at the degree that they're capable of going. You don't simply want them to be where you want them to be. You have to start where they are and then lead them. And I think just to understand where our culture is, this could be the way to make that first touch and, where the second or third steps go, because I remember watching you on the firing line debates and Philip Johnson as well in some of his debates. The other side is always screaming religion before even the first question is addressed. They're almost scared to deal with this on a scientific basis. They want to kind of muddy the waters by saying, oh, this is religion, and you're trying to say, no, this is good science.
Yeah, that's right. As you said, these questions do have deep implications for where we came from, what our origins are, and what our purpose is. And people can see it coming a mile away. So one can start speaking about intelligent design, and you can stick as close to the scientific issues as you possibly can. But nonetheless, people who don't like the implications of intelligent design oftentimes try to derail the conversation. And in my own writings, the reviews of my books and so on, frequently the first thing that somebody starts talking about is biblical creationism and the Scopes monkey trial and things like that, where I don't mention the Bible in my book at all. I don't talk about Scopes trial or anything like that, but nonetheless, they try to put these ideas in a little niche, in a little box, so that they can persuade people to ignore them without really trying to see what the ideas are.
I think they're scared to death of your arguments.
Well, it's certainly gotten a lot of attention, and I think you're right. The National Academy of Sciences has published a book called Science and Creationism, which is kind of a companion piece to their national science education standards. And in that book, they try to dismiss my arguments, and I can't get into it right now, but from my perspective, are very weak arguments. But when one has the National Academy of Sciences trying to dismiss these arguments out of hand without really addressing them, then you think that, you know, perhaps these ideas are really getting to people at the very highest level, and they're becoming concerned.
Okay. Mortimer Adler's great book, How to Read a Book, says when you should need to pay a lot of attention to an author's title. Now, I'm sure a lot of our listeners don't have a clue what your title means, Darwin's Black Box. It's a fascinating title. What do you mean by Darwin's Black Box?
Well, yeah, black box has a couple different meanings, and you know, sometimes people think it's the little thing in an airplane that records voices and so on. But in science, black box means some machine or system or something that does something very interesting, but you don't know how it works. You don't know how it works because you can't see inside the black box. The inner workings are obscure. And so while it does something, you can't tell how it does that. Well, it turns out that to Darwin and his contemporaries, the cell, which we know to be the basis of life, the cell was a black box. They knew it did interesting things. It reproduced, it could move, it could ingest things and so on. But they didn't know how it worked. And many scientists of the time, because they didn't know how it worked, kind of assumed that it must be something simple. It must be doing what it does by some simple process. And so they thought that the cell was kind of like a little glob of protoplasm, kind of like a little microscopic piece of jello. And with the scientific progress we've made in the past century, we've seen that this view is completely wrong, that rather than being simple, the cell is horrendously complex. And it's got thousands and tens of thousands of different parts and precisely ordered machines which conduct the business of life at the molecular level. And so Darwin's Black Box, by that title, I was trying to get across the point that what science has discovered at the foundation of life was completely unexpected by Darwin and really is very difficult to reconcile with his ideas.
Now, you know, a time perspective on this, because all of us listening to this broadcast grew up watching these marvelous photographs of the cell in Life magazine and National Geographic and such. But to Darwin, he couldn't see what we see today.
That's right. The microscopes of the 19th century were really very crude compared to what we've got. Just one aspect is they didn't have electric lights back then, so the lighting for the microscope was poor. Magnification wasn't so good, and so on. So they could see cells. As a matter of fact, cells were first seen in the 1600s, but they couldn't see much more than the outside of the cell. They could see a dark spot inside the cell, which turned out to be the nucleus. But that's pretty much the resolution. It's kind of like looking at a city from, if you were on the moon and had a telescope looking down at the Earth, a telescope you'd get at some toy store, and you could see maybe the outlines of a city or a light or something like that, and trying to figure out all of the machinery that helps make a city run or helps make a factory run based on that. They just didn't have the tools to know what we know today.
Okay. Now, let me just try to bring this in perspective and also get it down to a level, perhaps because your book is somewhat difficult at parts. So we're talking that the cell you mentioned has actually thousands of parts, intricate mechanisms.
Right.
And it's complex, which I think you use the term irreducible complexity is the nature of the cell. You use the analogy of a mousetrap to show why you had to have intelligent design for a cell to exist. Tell us about your mousetrap.
Well, Darwin's theory says that you start with something that's working a little bit, and natural selection can select improvements that are made just by accidents. You know, if there's a mutation, there's a system is improved a little bit and then improves a little bit more. And at each step, natural selection can gradually try to improve the working of a system. But it turns out there are things that can't be improved gradually. And as you said, I called these things irreducibly complex. And it's a fancy phrase, but it stands for a simple idea. It just means that you've got some machine or some system or something that has a number of different parts, and the parts interact with each other to do something that the individual parts can't do. And the example I use is a mousetrap. Now, the mousetraps you buy at a hardware store have a number of different parts. Generally, they have a wooden platform to which everything's attached and kind of a tightly wound spring, and the spring has an extended ends to press against the platform, and another arm presses against a little metal piece called the hammer, which actually squashes the mouse when it comes along. And when you push the hammer over, you've got to stabilize it in position until the mouse comes, and there's a little metal piece called the holding bar to do that. And the end of the holding bar has to be inserted into another metal piece called the catch to stabilize it. Now, all of these parts are needed for the mousetrap to work. If you take away the holding bar, you take away the spring, or any other piece, you don't have a mousetrap that works half as well as it used to, or a quarter as well as it used to. The whole thing is broken. So trying to evolve something like that by gradual Darwinian natural selection is really difficult to envision. What would you start with if you wanted to evolve a mousetrap? Would you, you know, start with a wooden piece and hope to catch some mice inefficiently, and then add the holding bar and hope to improve your efficiency a little bit more? Now, you can't do it like that, because with irreducibly complex systems, they essentially have to be complete before you get the function at all. And it turns out there are many things like that in the cell at the basis of life. So it looks like many things at the very foundation of life have this property of irreducible complexity and therefore are very unlikely to have come about by Darwin's process of natural selection working on random mutations.
So a mousetrap with less than a dozen parts, they all need to work together in order to catch one single mouse. The cell having thousands of parts that all need to work together, the probabilities of this just happening by chance would approach zero.
Yeah, it's slim.
Yes. Yeah. Well, where do I find more about intelligent design? Any of your colleagues, any of their resources or any websites that you might recommend?
There's a couple of places. First is a website for an organization called Access Research Network, and it's www.arn.org. And they have a number of articles I've written posted online, and articles also by Philip Johnson, who is a very prominent person in the intelligent design movement, and books by him as well. And also there's a website for the Discovery Institute. I'm a fellow of the Discovery Institute, which is a kind of a think tank based in Seattle. And one of their issues of concern is the relationship between science and religion in society. And they have a number of articles, again, by myself and Phil Johnson and a man named Stephen Meyer, who's a professor of philosophy at Worth College and a prominent design proponent as well. And I would recommend the
Let
book.
Let me see. Is that discovery.org?
Yes.
Okay.
It's discovery.org.
And then the other one is arn.org.
That's right.
Okay.
And there's also a new book out by a man named William Dembski, and his last name is spelled D-E-M-B-S-K-I, and he's currently at Baylor University, a professor down there. And he is he's got doctorates in both mathematics and philosophy. He's really overeducated.
Really challenged, I take it.
Yeah. Earlier, I gave your listeners a little analogy about a jungle trap and how you recognize design in that. Well, he takes the design argument and treats it really rigorously, as an academic should, and talks about the philosophical and mathematical underpinnings of how we come to a conclusion of design. And he's also a very committed Christian, and he has recently published a book for which I wrote the introduction, which is called Intelligent Design, The Bridge Between Science and Theology. And that's published by InterVarsity Press, I believe.
Okay.
And that's a very nice introduction to the topic as well.
Great. Well, there's some great resources for folks to get going. And again, we recommend you start with Darwin's Black Box. We have Tom on the line with us from Jacksonville. Tom, welcome to Faith and Family.
Great show. Thanks for the topic. Michael, I've got a question. I haven't read your book. But in your book, are you more or less trying to debunk natural selection and also prove God, or are we trying to say, how did God create?
Well, I'm not trying to prove God. God can do, you know, pretty well by himself. I'm a biochemist, and what I'm trying to do in the book is to address a scientific problem, a biochemical problem. That is, if you study biochemistry, you run across these enormously complicated systems in the cell. I didn't really mention any today, but just to give one example is there's something called the bacterial flagellum. And the flagellum is quite literally an outboard motor that bacteria use to swim. And it's got a little propeller which swings around, which pushes against the water. And the propeller is attached to the drive shaft of the motor by something called the hook region, and the drive shaft is attached to the motor, which uses a flow of acid from the outside of the cell to the inside to power it, and there's all these different parts which have to be together to make the flagellum work. And so in my book, I go through a number of examples like the flagellum and explain why they are not well explained by Darwin's theory, show that, in fact, no scientist has explained how they could have been produced. Essentially, it's just been assumed that they are products of evolution. And okay. Then I go on to explain how we apprehend design, like the jungle trap. What is it about things that makes us realize that they are the products of an intelligent activity? The problem is that when people talk about evolution, when Darwinists especially, is they come up with what are known as just-so stories. That is, like Rudyard Kipling wrote about how the tiger got its stripes and how the elephant got its trunks, you know, and it just happened like this. And oftentimes the explanations have very little data behind them. And so when it's seen in nature some condition or state which on the face of it looks like it is antagonistic to Darwin's theory, Darwinians essentially come up with loose stories to try and explain how something could how this thing could still be compatible with Darwin's theory. And the problem is one can explain something or explain it away depending on the needs of the moment, and one really isn't doing science at that point. One's just essentially trying to protect your theory.
Okay, we have one more caller. We're down to just a little over a minute, but Felice from Cape Coral, welcome to Faith and Family, and a quick last question for Michael Behe.
Hi, gentlemen. I'm delighted with the subject. Michael, I have read your book, and I think your case for an intelligent designer is very compelling. How about those of us who do take Genesis literally? How can your findings help us?
Well, again, intelligent design is neutral with respect to how the design was implemented. So people who do, in fact, take Genesis literally can just point to the really amazing creations in the cell as just another piece of evidence that, in fact, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And you know, most people think of life as some sort of, you know, mishmash of protoplasm at the cellular level. But if you can show people that even at the basis of life, that intelligence and planning is required to put it together, then you've essentially prepared the ground for getting them to see that perhaps other things in life are the result of intelligent design as well.
Thank you, Michael Behe, for being our guest on Faith and Family. And I would like to recommend to our listeners Dr. Michael Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. Parents, I encourage you to read this book so you can have discussions with your high school student as well as your college student. And it would make a tremendous gift to any young person heading off to college or in college. Until next time, this is Steve Wood with Faith and Family.
Faith and Family is a radio outreach of Family Life Center International. Visit us online at familylifecenter.net. To order a CD copy of today's broadcast, order online at www.familylifecenter.net.